Rancho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So we are recording this on Monday morning for scheduling purposes. We had to squeeze it in now. The transfer window in Serie A is still open for another 6 hours or so. So we're going to recap what we saw over the weekend in Serie A. A lot of exciting matches. We are going to talk, unfortunately, about what happened to Lukaku and Cagliari in our winners and losers segment. We have two great interviews. We are going to focus on Milan with our friend Matt Santangelo. And we are going to close the podcast with one of my favorite returning guests, Mark Doyle, who is based in Bologna. So we're going to talk about Mihailovic, Bologna, go around the league with him. So it should be a great episode. As usual, we have Twitter questions and a special section of the podcast with patrons. But at the top, I am joined by our dear friend, the producer, co-host of this podcast, Alex Goldberg. So Alex, I have a couple of topics I want to talk to you about. I want to start with Koulibaly and De Ligt. That Juve-Napoli game on Saturday was absolutely tremendous. Not so much for the defenders. So we had De Ligt struggle in his first start in Serie A against one of the best offenses. And we had Koulibaly, who had an own goal in stoppage time. So Alex, I know we live in the world of overreacting, prisoner of the moment's kind of one of our taglines on the podcast. So I want to ask you, in your opinion, who is overreacting more? Those who are criticizing Koulibaly and saying, oh, Napoli should have sold him, he's not good, he's distracted, or those that are really questioning Juve's acquisition of De Ligt right now?
Well, David, I'll be honest. I think both are to criticize if you're blaming those parties to that extent. Now, I guess I have a little humble pie to eat on De Ligt, but really I don't. It's one game, and I'm not going to be like most of reactionary Twitter and say that De Ligt is the Dutch Phil Jones, or De Ligt is a bust, and De Ligt is overrated, and he's going to stink. No, not at all. Just wasn't a good first game for him. Pretty simple. And in my opinion, De Ligt was kind of pressing, if you know what I mean. It really looked like he wanted to justify all the hype in that game, where he got absolutely spun by Lozano. It just looked like he was trying to really showcase himself. And as a center back, it's tough to do that. It's tough to actually just showcase yourself. A winger can showcase themselves, but as a center back, sometimes you have to play a little bit more disciplined. So I think it's pretty obvious that De Ligt was just kind of not necessarily as comfortable as he normally is in that first game. So I would heavily criticize those who criticize him and say that he's an overrated acquisition. But I would have to even come down harder on people with the Koulibaly criticism, because, I mean, that own goal, you think he wanted to score that? I mean, do you really think that that's going to happen again? Do you really think that Koulibaly is now all of a sudden washed up and he should be gone? Come on, get a grip. I mean, it's just the ultimate prisoner of the moment take. And David, I also just wonder if that goal had maybe been the first goal that Juventus scored, the Koulibaly own goal, or if it was against Calgary or a lesser team, would there be these takes? No, probably not. But losing to Juventus in that fashion, obviously, people just, you know, this is a broader take here, David, but I've learned myself, obviously, in covering Chelsea, but just covering football in general. When a team suffers a loss or a frustrating result, everybody wants to point the finger at one person. And it's just not that easy. Sometimes there are multiple things to blame. And Koulibaly, obviously, is the scapegoat here. And I think that's just really, really unfair. So I would say really both players are getting too much criticism, but I'd come down harder on the ones that are going crazy over Koulibaly. So, David, that's my take. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with you that both are woefully exaggerated. And you'll hear, and when I chatted with Mark Doyle at the end, he made a very astute point on De Ligt, and I'll let him, since he came up with that, cover that. But I will say that I have to say, when I heard that Chiellini tore his ACL, and best of wishes to Giorgio, my first reaction was I wouldn't be surprised if Demiral or Rugani started ahead of De Ligt, just because I know how long it takes for new players to adapt to Serie A. De Ligt also joined Juve a little bit after Demiral towards the beginning part of August. So I was kind of surprised that he started. I think Juve, though, knew the reaction was like, Chiellini's out, you're not starting your €75 million defender. There would be questions. So I'm with you. I'm sure he'll be fine in due time. But I agree with you. Those who watch Serie A closely, yeah, if you're really questioning Koulibaly, that really is a prisoner of the moment take. Like, look, he's going to be for the second time in our row in our losers segment. I don't think that's going to happen again. Keep in mind, he did return from the Africa Cup, didn't join Napoli until mid-August, had really no preseason with them, has two new defensive partners, Manolas and Di Lorenzo. Di Lorenzo also got torched there, so they'll be fine. I agree there. But I want to talk about another topic with you, and you've watched Higuain at Chelsea last season. I have to say, I'm absolutely floored by the way Higuain has played. I thought even in the first match against Parma, looked pretty good. Against Napoli, he scores a really brilliant goal there. So I have to ask you, like, and, you know, at this point, it looks inevitable that Dybala is also going to stay at Juve. They're going to have very deep front line. Looks like Mandzukic staying as well. So I want to ask you, like, what role do you envision for Higuain at this Juve? And the other thing I want to ask you is, how much do you think confidence plays for Higuain? Because you saw him at Chelsea. We thought maybe being with Sarri would energize him. We thought maybe being the focal point at Milan, but he seems just much more loose in these first two games. So tell me a little bit what role you envision for him and how much confidence plays a part in his success.
Yeah, he definitely seems like one of those strikers that needs that confidence and needs things to kind of be going well for him. And really, I think a lot of strikers are like that. There are very few that are able to really just shrug off a bad spell or maybe hostility between him and the manager or with other players. I mean, there are a lot of strikers who need things to be really comfortable for them, and then they get rolling. I think Higuain is definitely one of those players. And I can say that, obviously, watching him at Real Madrid, watching him at Napoli, watching him at Juventus the first time. But obviously, at Chelsea, it was pretty apparent that things felt a bit forced, obviously, with him coming in January, but he was really marketed as somebody that was going to save Chelsea's season, that Sarri was finally getting his player. So there was just a lot there for Higuain to really get past in terms of expectations and pressure, and he didn't do great with it. I mean, he didn't do great with it. And even at times, there were rumors and even videos of him not necessarily getting along great with his teammates. So I think being back at Juve now, he feels more comfortable. And for whatever reason, he is the starting striker right now, which is just astonishing. And I echo how kind of floored you are by how things are going so far with him. So I think confidence is a huge deal. And how much of a role can he have in this Juve team? Well, I mean, it's great to start off well, because if for some reason he didn't start these first two games, then I feel like it would be just so much harder for him to get in this team. But starting off well, and not only starting off well, but being big in a victory over Napoli, his former team, and obviously one of Juve's direct rivals, that's got to be big. Some games are not equal to others, David. I think we know that. All games are not created equal. So that could really buy him some time. And yeah, I guess Dybala staying certainly raises the question of, could Dybala win that spot after a while? Could Ronaldo win that spot? There are other options. But I now, all of a sudden, I can't be a prisoner of the moment and say all of a sudden Higuain is just going to be like he was a few seasons ago on Juve. But I all of a sudden now think that he might be a player that gets into at least every Serie A game if he's fit. Now, I'm not saying start every Serie A game, but maybe he now is going to be a fairly regular contributor. I just don't necessarily still have a lot of confidence that he's going to be this outright starter for the duration of the season. I still think something else happens on that front, but I will say I'm starting to shift on thinking about how important he's going to be for Juve, because that goal was class. So once again, I hate to overrate maybe one player, one game, but that made me a little bit more of a believer of what he has left. So I'm starting to shift that he'll be more important, David, but I'm not ready to go overboard. So that's my take. What about you?
So I tweeted, and I firmly believe in this. It feels like Higuain right now is in the John Travolta and Pulp Fiction phase of his career. Used to be a huge name, completely disappeared, gets this unbelievable role in a classic movie and really excels, and for a while gets back under the spotlight. And that's exactly what he's been. Like, look, I don't want to overreact. I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment, but he has played really well, even against Parma, kind of opening spaces for Ronaldo, him and Douglas Costa and Ronaldo. That's a very intriguing front line. Let's see what happens there, but it's going to be very interesting to see how Sarri integrates Dybala, Bernardeschi, Mandzukic. I mean, they really have a stacked front line. Okay, Alex, so I mentioned at the top, the transfer window is still open as we're recording. So as we're recording now, Icardi has left Milan. He is on his way to Paris to take a medical for PSG. If everything goes well, he's going to join them on loan with option to buy. So it's been an unbelievable saga. Since our last podcast, we had Wanda Nara and Icardi threatening to sue Inter over damages. And now we have this. They actually got in a plane to go to Paris and PSG to all teams. So what's your reaction when you hear this news?
Wow. I mean, all right, raw reaction, I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's going to work. Now, it's good for Icardi that he's going to go somewhere and play football rather than continue this ridiculous soap opera where nothing was getting accomplished, just absolutely nothing. So on the last episode, I think we had a question from maybe a patron saying, could Icardi's career already be over? And you obviously were not ready to go there yet, smartly so. So now we kind of know that his career is not over. However, I still don't think this is going to work out. Will he put in goals? Yeah, if he gets playing time, absolutely he'll put in goals. It's Ligue 1, and no disrespect to Ligue 1, but it's a league where good players come from, great players come from, but the competition in that league is just not great. He'll put in goals. He'll have, assumingly, Neymar and Mbappe around him for much of the season, and a damn good team. So, statistically, he could resurrect his career a little bit. But PSG's goal, David, is to win the damn Champions League. I think that's quite obvious. I mean, it really is Champions League or bust for them. I mean, almost even more than Juventus, just because the league competition in Ligue 1 is just so dire. Winning that league really means not a whole lot at all. So PSG, I've talked about for quite some time, and I'm not the only one. There's something missing in their team, whether it's a chemistry issue, a leadership issue, just a continuity issue. Maybe they're not tested enough in league, so then when they're in the Champions League, they're just not prepared enough. But I don't see how this dressing room gets any better with Icardi in the mix. In fact, probably worse. Probably worse. Now, I know Wanda Nara is a huge thing here, so if she stays away, maybe Icardi gets along swimmingly with his teammates there. But if I'm a betting man, David, I say that PSG win the Ligue 1 title again. Icardi has a decent statistical season. He's back on the map. But if I'm a betting man, I'm also saying there's going to be drama and there's not going to be a Champions League title. I am damn confident about that. I will really wear it if I'm wrong. I guarantee you PSG will not win the Champions League, and acquiring Icardi didn't help at all in that hunt. I really expect something to maybe brew towards the end of the season. So I'm very mixed on it because I now think Icardi's at least back on the map, but I don't think PSG are necessarily any closer to winning a Champions League title. So that's my raw reaction, David. What about you?
Man, a lot to unpack. So I'll start that I'm very disappointed. I really would have loved to take a victory lap over Icardi staying at Inter because I felt pretty passionately that there was a very good chance it would happen way back when he lost the captain's armband. So I came close, but no cigar. So a couple of reactions. A, Inter really did live up to what they said, that they were going to get rid of all the bad apples on the team. Perisic, Nainggolan, Icardi, pretty much all of them gone on loan. Inter was like, you know what? We just want to get rid of you and move on. To a lesser extent, Miranda and João Mário fall in that category as well. So Inter really did live up to their thing of trying to shed the Pazza Inter moniker. The other thing, I think if you're an Inter fan, you have to be happy that and I'm assuming the medical goes through, but with them, you really never know. But I'm going on the assumption it goes through. You have to be happy that he's leaving Italy. I think him going to Juve or Napoli definitely had the potential of coming back to bite them because, you know, look, he's a great player, but he would have been a very motivated player to do damage to Inter. The other thing is that I find really interesting is that we spent a lot of this year wondering if Icardi and Dybala would be swapped for one another. It didn't happen, but interestingly, it was Dybala who up until last week seemed like he could go to PSG if Neymar moved. That didn't happen. Neymar's still at PSG, and there goes Icardi. So they are still connected in a way. So a lot to unpack. This is a loan deal. He is extending his contract with Inter as part of this. So it's very possible that next summer we're back at square one, but I think it was absolutely imperative for Inter to try to get rid of the distraction, and they succeeded. So one more thing, Alex, the transfer gods were good to us out of the blue. Last night, we had the reports of Henrik Mkhitaryan joining Roma. He took the medical. We just tweeted a picture of it on Di Marzio's site of him taking the medical. So I want to ask you, he's obviously a big name. He's been linked to Serie A in the past. But how much do you think he has left? Do you think he can actually make an impact at Roma?
I'm pretty skeptical. If you were to have asked me what type of player do Roma need, I wouldn't have told you someone like Mkhitaryan. And that's not a massive insult, but I just don't really see where he fits the need. Maybe except if they think they just need somebody who's an attacking midfielder who can have a good game every once in a while, fine. But so many people fall into that category. He's 30 years old. Age-wise, it's like, okay, I guess, you know, it's not over the hill. And he's experienced. But I don't expect him to be an experienced player who's going to go in and be a leader. That's not what he is. And he's very far past his best days, which were at Borussia Dortmund. I would not say he was a big hit in the Premier League at all. I mean, he does have somewhat of positional versatility because he can kind of play all across the front three from an attack, not a striker's standpoint, but he can play on the left. He can play kind of as a number 10, can play on the right. But really, it's just underwhelming. I mean, it really is. So I'll say about him that he can have that good game where, man, he could chip in with like a goal and two assists and everything's clicking, but just be prepared for him to almost become forgotten for long stretches at a time. So I'm just woefully underwhelmed by it. And really, you can raise a question to how good was Mkhitaryan ever, because he put up stats at Borussia Dortmund, but a lot of people put up stats at Borussia Dortmund. I mean, a lot of people. When he was there, yeah, he had a nice stat line of 11 and 15 one season, and then 9 and 10 one season. I mean, he had a Aubameyang to give the ball to. And really, look at the players who have put up stats at Borussia Dortmund. Some of them are world-class no matter what, and some of them are putting up stats because they're at Borussia Dortmund, and that's just kind of what happens. So I think you could raise a question of how good was Mkhitaryan ever? So pretty damn underwhelming. So how much of an impact can he have? A very inconsistent one is what I'll say, David. All right. So that was our first segment, but I'm very happy to move on to the next segment because it still feels brand new since the season is still so young. So we're going to do our second edition for the 19-20 season of Winners and Losers, David. Let's start off with the winners. Who are winners of this past weekend?
So I will say this, was another fantastic weekend of Serie A action, a lot of exciting matches, and I will say it once again, rightfully, the attention outside of Italy and outside of the Serie A bubble is focused a lot on what happened in Cagliari. We'll get to that in the loser segment. So I don't want to sound, you know, crass over, you know, going over the positive things we saw over this weekend, but we certainly did see a lot of them on the pitch. Let's start with that Juve-Napoli game. Absolutely fantastic drama. Let's start with Juve winners. Douglas Costa has looked absolutely devastating playing in Sarri's system. Higuain scored a goal against his former team. He had played well against Parma, kept that going. We had Danilo, who scored his first goal for Juve 30 seconds in, came in to replace Desciglio. I actually thought he looked pretty good during that match overall. And another shout-out, you know, we talk a lot about Higuain. I'm also surprised that Matuidi has started both matches, and he's played well against Napoli. Maybe he can play kind of that Allan role that we saw in Sarri's system at Napoli. While Napoli did lose, there were some positives. Lozano made a clear impact off the bench. I'm very intrigued to see how Ancelotti can use him because he's so versatile. We had Mire with he did give up a lot of goals, but also had a good performance. I think he's a great keeper for Napoli. And we had Fabian Ruiz with a solid performance as well. Then we had Milan, who did end up beating Brescia. It wasn't pretty. It actually got better in the second half when Paqueta came in. So he's a winner. Even Piontek, who came off the bench, had a lot of scoring chances. He was denied, came really close a few times. But I think you got to be encouraged with what you saw from Piontek. Same with Suso, who looked a lot better in the Christmas tree formation as opposed to as a trequartista. And we had Calhanoglu score Milan's first goal of the season. For Brescia, we want to give a shout out to their new keeper, Jesse Joranen, had a lot of impressive saves. Then let's go to the derby in Rome. I thought Milinkovic-Savic had another strong performance off to a good start this season. Luis Alberto tied the match. He's off to another great start as well to the season. On Roma's side, I thought Zeko played really well, although he didn't score. I was really encouraged by what I saw from Zaniolo. To me, he looked like a lot more like the player we saw in February, March, where he looked like a world beater compared to the one that struggled a little bit towards the end of the season. Although Lazio didn't win, I think they have to leave that match feeling really good about themselves. I felt really good about picking Lazio to finish ahead of Roma at the beginning of the season. I've seen nothing to change my mind so far. I actually think the gap might even be bigger than I thought it was. Then we had Sassuolo, another team that I've been very high on. And they beat Sampdoria. We had Berardi with a hat trick. Right now leads Serie A in goal scores. Shout out to De Zerbi, one of my favorite managers in Serie A. Sassuolo is going to be a very intriguing team this season. Then we had Genoa, another team we were pretty high on going into the season, who now have 4 points. They beat Fiorentina, drew at Roma, the Olimpico. Very good start to them. Andrea Zoli, Empoli's former manager, definitely starting to have an impact there. Then we had Torino, who recovered from the elimination in the Europa League, beat Atalanta on an away match. That was a big win. Very high on Torino this season. Then we had Parma, 3 goals away at Udinese, Gervinho with a good performance. Important win for them after they had lost at home to Juve. Then, of course, we have Inter at Cagliari. We had Lautaro Martinez score his first goal since March in Serie A. Lukaku converted the penalty in really bad circumstances that we'll get to in a second. Also, shout out to Hellas Verona, who now have 4 points. They drew the first match against Bologna at home. They beat Lecce in an away match. Those are 3, although it's just the start of the season. Those are some really important points there. And then the final winner, this is kind of a joke, but not really. Manager Stefano Pioli yesterday tweeted that he's probably checking the ringtone on his phone to make sure it's on. Surprise, getting a call soon. His former team, Fiorentina, really struggling. Sampdoria, who he's been linked to, off to a poor start as well. I wouldn't be surprised if he's the first manager that gets hired to replace one that's sacked.
Okay, David. Well, good to certainly touch on the winners, but there's always kind of a yin-yang here, so now we have to naturally move to the losers of the weekend.
Okay. So as I mentioned, Sampdoria and Fiorentina, 0 points so far. I got all the enthusiasm on Fiorentina and all their young players, but I'm still pretty skeptical on them. And it's not just Montella. It's just a lot of young players in Serie A. Usually isn't a good recipe for success. Also, Sampdoria have lost decisively their first two matches. You know, important to note, they lost two of their best players in Anderson and Pryor. We mentioned Napoli, Koulibaly, and Di Lorenzo struggled defensively. Di Lorenzo at least scored a goal in the match, but he got exposed in the first half quite a bit. We have to put De Ligt on the losers, but I'm sure he'll recover fairly soon. Then we have Atalanta, who gave up 3 goals to Torino. Skrtel, who they had signed a few weeks ago to bring that Champions League experience, has already rescinded his contract. He's being replaced by Kjær, a Danish center back who used to play in Serie A in the past. And then the final loser and the biggest loser of the weekend is what happened at Cagliari, a black eye for all of Serie A. And I've said it at the top, you know, it's a real shame because I feel like Serie A really has so much going for it. The games are genuinely exciting. I think the coverage on ESPN Plus here in North America, there's just really great opportunity for the league to make great inroads. But then you look, you know, the headlines on sites like Deadspin, sites that have huge following. Headline they have, Italian soccer fans are being racist as hell again. So this is the storyline that comes out of Serie A. And again, to me, it's rightful that it's this way. Just because it's a real shame doesn't mean that it's not right. And the league really needs to do a lot more about it. Cagliari issued a statement today, which was the typical, yeah, you know, isolated incidents. It's too bad. It really gives a bad name to our great fan base. And we do all these great things for kids in our stadium. And we are going to take action, but we need help to do it. It was a typical PR statement. They also ran it in English. You can read it there. I got to say, I would have been a lot more impressed with a list of names of fans that were just being banned from the stadiums. That's what they do in the Premier League. I'm waiting for that to happen, but I'm not holding my breath. So real shame for what's happening. A clear black eye for the league. Sadly, though, I'm not surprised that it happened again in Cagliari, but it's very important that our listeners don't think that this is just an issue in Cagliari. It happens very obviously there, but it happens in most stadiums in Italy. So with that out of the way, though, now let's talk a little bit about Milan with our friend Matt Santangelo. Please know we did record this before the news on Ivan Rebic, who is expected to be officially announced any minute. We'll talk about Rebic when we recap the summer transfer window, but we took a deep dive on Milan with our friend Matt Santangelo.
So I'm very excited to be joined by our next guest, the very good friend of the show, Matt Santangelo. You guys have read him writing a covering calcio for quite some time on Football Italia, These Footy Times, Gentleman Ultra, and he is the co-host of a really excellent podcast called State of Play Pod that I strongly recommend. It has a really nice format, fresh ideas, all good stuff on there. So, Matt, it's a real pleasure to chat with you. Welcome back to Calcioland.
David, thanks for having me back on, man. I really appreciate it.
Always fun to chat with you. So we are going to talk about Milan. We are recording right after that wild Juve-Napoli match. That Milan game, which was only a few hours ago after that Juve game, feels like a week ago. But let's start with the lineup, because I want to ask you this. I had sent you the questions ahead of time. I was going to ask you about the game right away, but before we get to the match, I want to ask, what was your reaction to the lineup? There's been a lot of talk about Gianpaolo with the formations. And out of the blue, we see Andre Silva starting, Piontek on the bench, also Paqueta on the bench. So what was your reaction when you first heard of that?
Well, I think in the build-up to the game, everyone expected some sort of tactical switch, right? Whether it would be a 4-3-3. I mean, he hinted at it even this post-match press conference after the Udinese loss. So I don't think that was really hardly a surprise to see. But the fact that he pulled Piontek and Paquette, I mean, Paquette started the first game, but you thought that if any switches were going to be made, a slight tactical switch, maybe Hakan and Suso as wingers and then one striker. But to see Piontek and Paqueta pulled, that was really surprising. I really caught me off guard. But I think, you know, when you look at it and you look at who kind of filled in those roles, Hakan obviously got the decisive goal, a header via cross from Suso. And Silva, he didn't look too bad in my opinion. I think there was mixed opinions on his performance overall. I think he did some things well. He had some good runs. He got on the ball off and he was involved. I think he drifted a bit too far wide into certain channels that maybe kind of left him out on an island by himself and isolated. But overall, again, at this point in the part of the season, Milan really just needed to get victories. The first three games are pretty light. They obviously Udinese, they lost. You have Brescia here at home. And then after the international break, you have El Verona before the Milan derby. So a big victory for Milan nonetheless. Surprisingly, I didn't expect the tactical switches he did make. But it really goes to show you that Gianpaolo is still trying to feel out who fits the scheme, what he has in certain players, what he doesn't, and ultimately who he can really rely on. And you're starting to see him feel out what his roster looks like. And I think the biggest thing that I take away from this is the fact that he played Silva. He could have went with a guy like Leao. He could have went with Piontek.
Yeah.
Both have roles this season. And instead he goes for Silva, a player who's been almost a shoo-in to be sold this summer. So it really gives me some sort of indication that perhaps Silva is going to be staying. And I think he really wanted to try him out and see what he can expect from him.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Silva thing, I was wondering if they were maybe showcasing him with the window ending. I thought he played okay. I mean, my expectations for him were really low. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what that was about. But let's talk a little bit more about the match. I want to ask you, tell me a little bit what you thought about Milan. Are you starting to see some differences from what we saw on the Gattuso? You starting to see Gianpaolo making somewhat of an imprint on the team? Did they look any better to you once Paqueta and Piontek came on in the second half?
Absolutely. I thought that the first thing I noticed, in this match versus the first one is that it was night and day in that Regista role. I thought Ismail Benacer, the new arrival from Empoli, AFCON player of the tournament, I thought he was really strong and he really provided exactly what Gianpaolo needed in his system in this match. Quick on the ball, very, you know, a good decision making, not taking those risks, but at the same time finding those windows where he feels he could. I think the midfield three for me moving forward, if it is 4-3-3 or 4-3-1-2, is Paqueta, Benacer, and Kessié. I think that is probably the most balanced midfield that Milan could have at this moment in time. But I was impressed with what Piontek and Paqueta were able to do off the bench in very short time. It's just kind of was a bit frustrating from my perspective because you were looking for that the entire game. You're against a team like Brescia, you should be wanting to bring it to them. And the fact that it took such a late point of the game for Milan to wake up and start creating chances. Piontek had three chances at the end where he could have had goals. Paqueta had a great strike, probably the best strike he's had in a Milan shirt. It gives some optimism that, okay, maybe that Milan, when they are in their full roster, again, we haven't quite seen them with their full squad and their projected best squad yet, but it just kind of is a little bit confusing as to why this hasn't been able to be shown early on in the matches against inferior opponents on paper and in name. And that's kind of what one of my biggest takeaways was. I guess, you know, we'll have to see how they fare against El Verona ahead of the derby, which is going to be really telling because obviously heading into that derby, Milan really do need to show up and play against Inter, who look very strong so far through one game.
Agreed. Okay, so now let's talk about the team more big picture, not just this match. So I want to ask you this, because when I look at Milan's summer transfer window, in a lot of ways, this is exactly what Ivan Gazidis had told Gazzetta dello Sport at the end of May, saying we're going for young players. We want to develop our own stars here. We can't go for the expensive players. We're not going to give you false promises. And when you look at what they did in the window so far, that's really to a T exactly what they've done. So I want to ask you, in your opinion, it's been a really difficult past 4 or 5 years. The patience with the fan base for this process.
That patience word is very hard to come by with Milan fans, and rightfully so. I think it's well understood with all the ownership switching. coaches coming in and out, players switching and really not delivering on expectations, I think it's really difficult for Milan fans to be patient, because obviously they see Inter and back in the Champions League two straight years. They see the project they're building with the coach. They see Juve and Napoli very strong and title contenders. So I think it's really frustrating as a Milan fan to see all these clubs, you know, kind of pass them by and really just get stronger by the summer. So I think patience is something that Milan fans do need to have, but it's very difficult at this time. And you're really seeing it on a weekly basis, right? You know, they can't even give a guy like Gianpaolo the patience for him to get his formation set in and pick the guys that he wants. Every decision's magnified. Everything is looked at so closely. And I think it's really hard for Milan fans to stay patient until they really get back to top four, because I'm not being in the Champions League, shall I say, because that's obviously the ultimate destination. And everything you mentioned about the market, it wasn't all that surprising to me to see the kind of activity. I think, you know, younger buys, look at the squad, it's very young. I think that's a young roster is what Milan has wanted, regardless of ownership, in the past couple of years. But I think Milan fans expected one sort of splash signing. Maybe something happens the rest of the way, maybe a Correa, maybe an Everton from Gremio, which looks kind of unlikely. But I think people have to also, you know, consider the fact that Milan did invest $70 million in January on Paqueta and Piontek. So in many ways, they have spent quite a bit this calendar year. And it's one of those things where Milan fans are never going to be patient. They're never going to be satisfied until they're in the Champions League. And that's really the aim. And that's, you know, a week-to-week thing that Milan fans have to deal with.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you say about Inter, because I think we are seeing with Inter the impact of going to the Champions League 2 years in a row, how much that has helped them on the market. So I think that's really what Milan has to absolutely do and then worry about the rest after that. So now let's talk a little bit about the squad, the individual players. So I think in a lot of ways what we saw from Bennacer and, you know, even Paqueta, who arrived before this summer, is the type of player that Gazzidis wants, these young players that are going to get better and that you can build around. When you look at Milan's squad, aside from those two, which I'm assuming you see as building blocks, any other player who you think, when Milan's back, hopefully where they belong in the Champions League regularly in 2-3 years, which ones do you see being part of that?
Right now, I can name five. Gigio Donnarumma, Alessio Romagnoli, your captain. He's been with the club since 2015-2016 when Mihailovic brought him over. Paqueta, Bennacer, and Piontek. I think, you know, right now Rafael Leao is a young player that they invested quite a bit in, so I think naturally you consider him to be a building block. But with a lot of these young players, you really have to see how they fare and how they adapt. But I would say those five, again, Paqueta, Romagnoli, Piontek, Bennacer, and Gigio Donnarumma. I think that's really the core group that Milan hopes to build around. If they can get another star in between, I think obviously the names I mentioned, if you notice, they're all very young players. Obviously, Romagnoli has experience, but I think the squad could really use a player in its prime that has that European, you know, that Champions League experience under his belt to kind of really carry the project forward even further. But right now, I think they have five guys you can really say are core players at the moment. But as a Milan fan, again, it really just comes down to whether or not they fulfill expectations and their goals, because obviously a guy like Donnarumma is in demand, Romagnoli, these guys, with the way the market is and balancing books and financial fair play, Milan have to tread lightly. They have to make sure they're meeting their objectives, otherwise they may run the risk of losing some of these guys.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think those guys, those five players, are good enough to be starters on a team that regularly gets to the Champions League. And I think that's well said. I think maybe Theo Hernandez, Leao, we need to see. There is a world where those guys can be part of that as well. But tell me a little bit, what's your opinion of Gianpaolo now that we have two games under his belt? Official, and if you had to bet, do you think Gianpaolo finishes the season as Milan's manager?
I do think Marco Gianpaolo is going to finish the season as Milan manager. I think if a guy like Gennaro Gattuso can finish the season off, despite having numerous spells where we thought he was going to get the sack, I think Gianpaolo will be given at least one season. I think it would be really short-sighted for Milan's ownership to just pull the plug on him. Obviously, we know what the expectations are. We know what the urgency is to get back to the Champions League. But I think any sort of project takes time. And as I said, patience and time are two things that maybe Milan fans don't have much of at this point in time or are willing to give. So I think that's really the toughest part here. But Gianpaolo's project, I think it could be promising. I think he's starting to get the players, or he's starting to get a feeling of what players fit again and what players don't. But as you just mentioned, Sampdoria and Empoli are two vastly different clubs in stature, history, and a pedigree on the world stage. So I think, you know, we can expect to have at least one. But any sort of project, even we saw a perfect example of what happened with Napoli with Maurizio Sarri, right? They hired him after a 15th or 14th place finish with Empoli, and it took 3 years for them to be 4 points, 5 points behind Juve for the title. So good projects do take time. And as I said, though, it's ultimately going to come down to whether or not they fulfill objectives, seasonal objectives, and with the pressure coming from fans all over Twitter, I got this part of the game now. It's really going to be a wait and see to see where Milan stand at the end of the season. If they're able to get fourth, job well done by Gianpaolo, and you move forward with the manager who got you there.
Okay, so now let's do a couple of over-unders. This is something we've enjoyed doing a lot on the podcast recently. So you have Gianpaolo finishing the season. Let's go with Piontek. I said the over-under for the season at 15.5 for him. Granted, today he wasn't in the starting lineup, but he did make an impact, as you said, when he came off. So if I set it at 15.5 for the entire season and said, yeah, are you taking the over or the under?
I'm taking the over. Maybe 2-3 goals more. I think that would be maybe 3 or 4 shy of what he did in the debut season in Italy last year. I think Gianpaolo's system in time will suit Piontek, and I think it'll allow a more creative style to come into play and in return create more chances for Piontek and leave him less isolated than he was at certain points last season under Gattuso, where he had that hot start, but the last month and a half, 2 months, he really was starved of service. So I think if he's able to get 18 goals this year, 19 goals, I think that's a great return for Milan. And I do think under Gianpaolo's system, I think it'll ultimately allow others to get goals as well, which if it's spread out a little bit evenly, Milan have some more attacking players who can get on the score sheet and make a difference instead of relying on one sole guy to carry all the weight. I think that would be a really big benefit for Milan. So I'm going to say around 17-18, so I'll hit the over there.
Okay. Well, you were big on the Piontek train from the get-go, so I'm glad you're sticking with your boy. So now let's go with Leao, and I'm going to set the over-under for him on number of starts in Serie A. Milan invested a lot in. We've seen Castileo start 2 games, and I got to say, man, I really hope that trend doesn't continue. If I set the over-under for Leao in Serie A starts, 23.5, are you taking the over or the under?
I'm taking the under. It's going to be slightly under, and I have my reasons for that. I think you're right now starting to see still Gianpaolo kind of weigh up his formations, right? The first match we saw 4-3-1-2. Second match we saw just one striker up there in Andre Silva, which leads me to believe that if he does, you know, flip-flop rotations and really tries to prepare for each match differently with formation, there could be those cases where you know, it's two strikers, but then maybe for this match, Piontek is the lone guy, and, you know, maybe Leao comes off the bench, and maybe there's a 4-3-1-2 in-game switch. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for Leao to start, yes, but I also think there's opportunity for him to come off the bench and for Gianpaolo to tinker in-match to ultimately get better results. So I do think he'll appear quite a bit for Milan, as you mentioned, in a big investment. But I think it's going to be slightly under in terms of starts. And I do feel he will get a lot of minutes and opportunity to show what he's worth.
I'm going to agree with you. I'm going to go under. Also, I need to see if Milan adds one more offensive player. But yeah, I think it's going to be in the neighborhood. But I'm with you there. Next one, Borini. I said the over-under for Borini starts at 11.5. So he started the season opener, didn't start today. Is he going to start another 11 games to go over this, in your opinion?
He is. And I think the reason why. Yeah. I think the reason why is we saw what happened last year with the injury crisis and how really Gattuso had to use every single player imaginable in his roster in order to get through the season. Not to mention Borini, despite maybe not being a master of one trade, but kind of a guy who can fill in certain different roles, I think that's something that Gianpaolo, like Gattuso, is going to utilize at some point during the season. You may see him occasionally at right back if Conte or Calabria are injured or not fit to go. You may see him in the midfield, maybe as a winger. So I think he'll get slightly over 11.5 starts, which would be probably upsetting to most Milan fans. But nonetheless, Verini's a guy who puts his head down, he works hard, he doesn't complain, and he puts in a good shift in some cases for Milan, regardless of where he's playing. So I would say slightly over.
Say this, I say of the Mirabelli group of additions, he was one of the better ones. And I mean, maybe that's saying more about the others, but I think he takes a lot of crap. I think he's a fine glue guy to have. I mean, they've made a lot worse deals than signing Borini. So last one, this is a fun one. I have yellow card Romagnoli for protesting. Last year, it had really gotten a little bit ridiculous. Now, we don't know exactly what he's saying or whatnot, but as the captain, it seemed he was getting a lot of yellow cards for simply protesting. So I'm going to set the over-under at 4.5 yellow cards just for talking to the referee. Are you taking the over or the under?
I'm going to go with the over slightly, and it's just because I think he's such an outspoken leader for Milan and exactly what they need in the back. But there's also the part of me that hopes that maybe Serie A will kind of lighten up on this and the officiating will lighten up on this, because I think as the captain, I think he has that right to at least approach the official, main official, and kind of have his say on what's going on. But we really don't know what we can expect on a weekly basis from officials and how they're going to go about, you know, officiating the game. So it would be hardly surprising to see Romagnoli pick up quite a bit of yellow cards this year for protesting. So I think I'm going to go slightly over on that with the 5 or 6. I just think he's outspoken. He's everything that Milan fans should want from their captain. And I think in certain moments where there's pressure, there's, you know, difficulty in certain matches, he's the guy that you want speaking. He's the guy you want as a mouthpiece on the pitch, having his say and getting his point across to the official.
Awesome. Well, Matt, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's always fun to chat Milan with you. You guys definitely check out Matt's excellent work. I really enjoyed the State of Play pod, the really good format, which I always think is the most underrated thing in podcasts. Also great writing on Serie A. So Matt, thanks so much for joining me. I look forward to chatting with you again during the season.
David, thanks a lot. Have a good one.
All right. Awesome. Really good to hear from Matt. Always nice to have him on. Always nice to read his tweets, etc. And always nice to read the questions we have here for this next upcoming segment. And that, of course, is Twitter questions. So, David, let's jump right in. First Twitter question. Who will be the first manager sacked in Serie A?
So I think Montella is the most obvious choice. So there's a new ownership group in Florence, Comiso. They inherited him. He has a long-term contract. They kept him. Anyone that follows Serie A knew he'd be a big liability. The results have been dreadful. So he's the obvious answer. I would say Di Francesco is probably going to get more of a leash. He was just hired, Sampdoria. You know, they are in transition. They did sell some top players. They tried to replace them. So I think Di Francesco is going to get a little bit more of a leash than Montella. So I think those are the two favorites right now.
Okay. All right, David, next one. What do you make of Danilo scoring in Serie A even before João Cancelo has been featured for Manchester City?
Well, obviously it's great for Danilo, but I will say this is once again proof that sometimes in life it's better to be lucky than good. I mean, De Sciglio got hurt. Danilo came in, scored right away. I thought he played pretty well. So, yeah, definitely a good start. But again, I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment because João Cancelo at Man City, man, that's really, really frightening in a lot of ways. But hey, good for Danilo. Maybe he can be one of those reclamation projects. You know, keep in mind, Juve had tried to sign him when he was at Porto, so maybe he'll surprise us. But I'd still much rather have João Cancelo.
Yeah, absolutely. And a player not featuring for Manchester City is really no surprise. Man, do they have players that are unbelievable that hardly ever play, and he obviously will. All right, next one. What aspect of Serie A do you find most underrated, David?
So I think it's just really how exciting the games have begun. I mean, the high-scoring games, that match between Juve and Napoli. I mean, how many games like that do we see in Serie A? Like, I think it's very frequent. You know, again, it's too bad things like Cagliari really take away from that. But I really think, like, now really the stereotype Serie A being boring and defensive, I mean, it just really shows incredible ignorance to still say that. I'm, you know, not to me, what's also underrated is how many managers are offensive minded and said, yeah, we've talked about De Zerbi, we've talked about Gasperini. I really like that we see more and more managers with the 3 points, like try to win flat out matches when maybe they would try to go for the draw. And I think we're seeing that, you know, from different level teams. So I would say the mentality has changed. I also think, you know, what's underrated is a lot of the storyline now is that Serie A is taking on a lot of the rejects from the Premier League. And I definitely think there is some truth to that. I mean, just look at how many arrived: Mkhitaryan, Smalling, Zappacosta. But also when you look overall, Icardi, if this deal with PSG goes through, assume it does, is really the only huge name that left Serie A to this summer. If not, we're looking at like Pride, Anderson, players like that. So you look at a lot of talent that stayed in Italy: Donnarumma, Dybala, Romagnoli. I could go with Zaniolo. So I definitely think there's a lot of positives going on with the league. But unfortunately, and again, I'm going to repeat rightfully, the Cagliari stuff is getting a lot of the attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a shame. All right, David, next Twitter question. Would Milan have been better off had Rocco Commisso bought the club?
Look, Rocco is rightfully getting a lot of praise and hype. He's doing a lot of things right, flashy moves, trying to be really engaged with the fan base, which I think is great. I think he's done a really nice job making an outreach with the fan base, who was really upset with the previous owners. But there's a big but. I mean, Milan, the Elliott Fund, they really inherited or co-signed the horrible situation back in the day with the Chinese. Milan have really such thin margins on the transfer market of trying to keep things in balance. So I'm not sure, had Commisso taken over Milan, he could have realistically done better. But I will say is that Milan, the whole MO of the club now is really minimal communication, silence. Commisso is the exact opposite of that. So in that sense, I think it would have been better. I'm just not convinced he would have been able to do a lot more on the transfer market.
Okay. All right, David. With Roma adding Kalinic and Chris Smalling on dry loans, is there an expectation they'll go with more long-term answers next summer?
So I think, you know, a lot depends if they make the Champions League or not. That's going to go a long ways. And look, you know, another listener sent in a question at the last second saying, you know, we're seeing all these loan deals. Do you think this is a trend? Will it continue? And I actually think it really will. I think, you know, in the era of FFP and the era, you know, big transfer fees and whatnot, I think you're going to see a lot more of these dry loans saying, you know what, let's not even haggle over the option to buy. Let's just ship the player out and then we'll figure it out. I think what happened with Kovacic at Chelsea is really an example of what you're going to see more and more of it. So I think, you know, you get clubs like Roma, until they are an FFP, are going to continue doing these loans. But I think this trend that we saw in the last 10 days of teams saying, okay, just ship them off on loan, we'll figure this out later on, is going to become more and more the norm, to be honest.
Okay. All right, David. Well, staying on Roma, what are your thoughts on Roma's transfer window overall?
So I've said it before. I think Petrarca rightfully got a lot of praise recently. I think they've done some good moves recently. I'm not going to say they're great moves because I always go back. Like, I like Zappacosta. I like Spinazzola. I like Diarra. I like Vertu. How many of them, though, could start for Inter and Napoli, never mind Juve? So there's that. And then I look at Roma, and I've said it many times, I think a lot of people focus on what they brought in, but maybe we're underrating how much they lost. Their defense is bad. Yesterday they gave up just one goal, but it could have been a lot more because off the post and woodwork were like the best addition Monchi made
to Roma. So they lost Manolas, lost De Rossi. El Shaarawy, to me, can be understated as a loss. So there's that. I do like the moves he made at the end, but he brings in Smalling and Mkhitaryan out of the blue. It's kind of like, you know, which players are available that I can just bring in? And he just brings them in. I guess it's better than nothing. The keeper, Paul Lopez, definitely looks like an upgrade over Olsen. That's not saying much. Played well yesterday in the derby. So I'm not as high on Roma as a lot of other people. Again, Petrarca inherited a lot of problems. Not his fault. Manolas, El Shaarawy, and De Rossi left. He did the best he could. So I'm going to give him a pretty good grade, but not a great grade for Roma's transfer overall. I think a lot really depends on Fonseca. We are seeing some very good offensive ideas. Defense, the personnel just isn't there. So let's see what happens.
Okay. David, were you surprised Juventus were linked to defenders after Chiellini's injury?
Yes and no. I will say, to me, the reason they were linked to defenders is I still think they were looking to make a plusvalenza on Rugani. Rugani has a very low amortized value. I think Juve was like, you know what? If we can make a plusvalenza on Rugani and bring in a veteran on loan, say Boateng, we'll do it. So to me, it was they would have only... It wasn't adding a veteran to replace Chiellini. In a lot of ways, it was like more to replace Rugani. And then it's like, okay, well, Chiellini's hurt, so maybe let's change the profile of the player we are bringing in. So yes and no.
All right, Dave. Well, let's move away from football for this question. What do you make of Tool's new record?
Okay, so it's been a great last few weeks for me pop culture-wise. We had Tarantino's new movie, who we've talked at length on the podcast. I suspect we're going to talk about Tool's new record a few times as well. But I got to say, it's been a great stretch pop culture-wise. I think both Tarantino and Tool completely delivered with their latest content. So the new album, Fear in a Column, love it. Probably the best metal album of the decade, probably my favorite metal album of the millennium after Lateralus, also a Tool record. You know, I think when I think of this record more than anything, to me, it's Adam Jones's coming out party. That's their guitar player. When I think when you're in a band with a singer like Maynard and a drummer like Danny Carey, who are rightfully considered amongst the best at what they do, he gets a little bit overshadowed, but you got him to hear play some slide guitar, some different lead solo styles on there. He really jumps out to me on this record. Some great tracks on it. Invincible and Descending to me are absolute Tool classics. I will say, in a way, the song that I liked the least was the single, the one that came out first, the title track. That's really my only criticism of the album. Usually the first track on a Tool record is just an instant classic. Not sure if that one is, but the rest of the record is simply incredible. So I'm sure we'll talk about it more. So thanks for sending in the question. So now let's get to our patrons. I want to take a moment to thank our patrons in the month of August. We had quite a few new ones, so we were able to make a nice donation to the Insuperabili nonprofit in Italy. They run football academies for kids with disabilities. Man, if you ever need a pick-me-up, you're having a rough day, like, check out the Insuperabili Instagram page or Twitter account. What this organization does is great, so I'm thrilled that thanks to our patrons, we can support them. So if you enjoy Calcioland, you get longer versions of the podcast, you get two weekly articles in certain tiers, you get a quarterly bonus podcast, and you also get to help a great nonprofit. So I am very excited to be joined by our next guest, his third appearance on Calcioland, our very good friend Mark Doyle, who is the deputy features editor at Goal. He works with our dear friend Carlo Garganese. So, Mark, it's always a pleasure to chat calcio with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's always good fun to be on the show, so I appreciate you inviting me back. I didn't even realize it was a hat trick, so I'm ecstatic.
Awesome, man. It's always fun to chat with you. So I'll tell you what, let's start with the Serie A weekend. We're recording this on Monday
morning. So this is a complete overreaction, but I think there is an interesting discussion surrounded here. So there was a lot of talk in the summer of Manolas and Koulibaly potentially forming the best defense in Serie A. De Ligt, of course, arrived with a lot of rightful hype at Juve. But obviously in that game on Saturday, things didn't go as planned for the players, especially Koulibaly and De Ligt. So not surprisingly, in the era of overreactions and prisoner of the moment, there's been a lot of takes on Koulibaly and De Ligt. So I want to ask you this. Obviously, there's way too much overreacting on this, but do you think there's any reason for concern that maybe Manolas and Koulibaly as a duo won't live up, or maybe De Ligt will struggle more in Serie A, and his De Ligt will struggle more in his first season in Serie A than expected? In your opinion, which of the two things should bring more concern to the respective fan bases?
As you say, it's very early days, but I suppose both will be concerned. This is Serie A. This is, we specialize in reactions of the knee jerk for a variety, as you've alluded to, even more so than most leagues. But as you said, we were expecting to see a masterclass maybe from a defensive perspective, given the talent on show, and we certainly didn't get that in a match that finished with seven goals. On paper, obviously Manolas and Koulibaly is a sensational centre back pairing. It looks complementary. Obviously, we've not seen any evidence of that whatsoever so far. Seven goals in two games is not what we were expecting whatsoever. But yeah, I think we need a little perspective. They've only just started playing alongside one another. As anyone who's played at the back would know, it takes a while at any level. You have to establish an understanding, to figure out who's going where, the positioning. That takes time, and then that takes training sessions, and that takes matches. So these are two quality players. They're two proven performers at this level. I think Koulibaly in particular is an absolutely phenomenal centre half. So. And another thing as well, I mean, Fiorentina and Juventus away are pretty two damn tough away trips, and not the easiest places to go, especially at the start of the season. So I think with time, Manolas and Koulibaly will be pretty formidable, as we all thought they would be. I'm not entirely sure now. Yeah, I have the same faith in Bonucci and De Ligt. Obviously, it was supposed to be Chiellini and De Ligt, and it would have been, I think, a great introduction to Serie A for De Ligt to have someone like Chiellini alongside him. So yeah, I would have thought that looks like a solid pairing on paper. Bonucci and De Ligt, I have my doubts. Obviously, I think they share too many similarities and too many of the same flaws. Perhaps I think without someone like Chiellini, the older, kind of more experienced, more grizzled defender alongside him, I think I used to always fear for Bonucci in a back two anyway. I think most Juve fans would have rather see De Ligt being introduced into Serie A, which is definitely going to be a tougher league for him. I thought it was interesting last week, actually, when Lozano had arrived in Naples. And then somebody said, and they were pointing out saying, it'll be more difficult for him in Italy, because in Italy they know how to defend. In Holland they don't, which, is a terrible slight on Dutch football. But I was talking to even some of our Ajax correspondents, and I said, in Holland there's a far greater emphasis on playing out from the back from playing offensive football. And in Italy, as we know, there's a far greater emphasis on defensive football and stuff like that. So I think he's going to take time to introduce, to settle. I think, as he said himself, Sarri even told him the first month is going to be the most difficult. So he's only just arrived. I think it's asking him a hell of a lot to expect him to suddenly take charge of the Juventus backline. So I think actually we will be concerned on both sides, but I would call for a little calm and a little patience if that's possible.
Yeah, very well said. And in addition, Koulibaly just came back from vacation, really didn't have time yet to play with Manolas. They also added a right back. But I think you make a very interesting point on the difference for De Ligt playing next to Bonucci rather than Chiellini. Mm. That's an astute observation. So now let's talk a little bit about the teams at the top. So as you said, Napoli had a very difficult start to the season. They had two tough away matches. Juve was able to win both games. I think they looked pretty good for, you know, she looked very good for a while against Napoli, then had against Parma, and in the second half against Napoli, struggled a little bit. And we had Inter beat two Provinciali, which they struggled with last year. So when you look at the landscape, in your opinion, between Napoli and Inter, without maybe overreacting too much of the two first games, but looking at the big picture, who has a better chance of keeping up with Juve, Napoli or Inter?
Yeah, I mean, I think even a month or so ago when we last spoke, I said Inter, and I've seen nothing over the past two games to change my mind in that regard. I think, yeah, if anything, the first two rounds of the new season have kind of solidified my stance. Yeah, as you said, I've seen a lot of people saying, no, Inter have only played Lecce and Cagliari, but as you've pointed out, we saw them struggle against sides like that last season. We've seen them struggle against, we saw them struggle again to break down sides at home in the past. That didn't happen at all against Lecce. They blew them away. In the past, they've also come undone in places like Cagliari, but they found a way to win. So I think that bodes well too. I think they've won two games in very different ways, and I think that can't be anything but encouraging in terms of their chances of actually sustaining a title challenge for the first time in years. So, I don't really think it matters where you stand on Conte, and I know full well a lot of Interisti don't like him particularly, and you know, because of the UVA background, and I get it. But I think you have to respect him as a coach, the desire, determination, the organization. You know, he's intense. Maybe players can wear thin with players after a while, but he's a winner. And as I said before, I think that's exactly what the Neto truly needed. I think he's the ideal coach to come into like an underperforming club and just whip people into shape. I think he almost revels in like restoring order in a chaotic situation. I saw that with Juve eight years ago. We saw that Chelsea 3 years ago. I mean, we even saw that on international level with Italy after the 2004 World Cup. So I thought all along he was the right man for the job, and I still do. And that's why I'd back Inter over Napoli.
Interesting. I have to say, I had Napoli, but you kind of swayed me a little bit there. So now let's talk about the derby, Roma and Lazio, which was a very interesting match. So I want to ask you two things. A, what were your main takeaways from what we saw? And then, and in your opinion, who is the better team between the two?
My main takeaway, I suppose, would be that these two will be good fun to watch, I think, again this season. In terms of who's better between the two, on the evidence of that game, Lazio 100%. I mean, they hit the woodwork about 67 times. They were very unlucky not to win the match. So I think they looked more organized. Maybe they lack a little bit of nastiness, as Inzaghi was saying afterward. But I think they have a better, clearer idea of what they're doing and what they're trying to do. And I mean, that's hardly surprising. Fonseca has only just arrived at the Olympico, and Zaghi has a serious head start on him in that regard. So I think it's only natural that Lazio look the stronger side right now. And let's be honest, like master of the market that Monchi may have been at Sevilla, he's kind of set Roma back a little bit with his transfer deals over the last couple of years. So I think they're going to take a little while to recover, and they've got a new coach as well. I mean, there are positives. Don't get me wrong. I see some very exciting young players going forward, but these guys are still raw. I like Mancini at the back, as I said before, from the under-21 European Championships. I think he'll be a great signing, but I don't think this Roma is as strong as the one that reached the Champions League semi-finals a couple of years back. I think that's pretty obvious. I don't want to be a downer on Roma. I think Fonseca will be true to his word, as we've seen already, that he's going to stick to his attacking principles. They're going to go for games, and I think that'll be great fun to watch this season, along with Lazio.
Yeah, I completely agree there. I mean, Roma really did have a lot of significant losses to their squad too. I think it's because they happened so long ago. Maybe we are underestimating the impact of those departures, but they are certainly fun to watch, no doubt there. Okay, so now we're going to talk a little bit more about mid-table topics, because I really enjoy talking to people like you that are based in Italy and have a first, hand knowledge and observations of these teams. So let's start here. I want to ask you about Ribery and Balotelli. So we had Ribery at Fiorentina and Balotelli at Brescia. In your opinion, who's going to have a better season between the two?
Good question. I don't know. Well, from a personal perspective, like, absolutely nothing against Ribery whatsoever, but I really hope it's Balotelli who has the better season. For all his flaws, for all the drama he brings and the baggage, I find Balotelli is still a compelling character, and maybe that's because of all the flaws and all the drama and all the baggage, but I'm also a sucker for kind of romantic returns, players going back to their roots and, you know, enjoying a renaissance. So, or even just excelling where when everyone else has kind of written them off. You know, God, I remember, you know, Baggio at Brescia or even my beloved Bologna. You know, great memories and great stories. So I really hope going back to Brescia is a going to Brescia, you know, his hometown, is a success for Balotelli. And as for Ribery, I mean, I spoke actually to our Bayern Munich correspondent only last week, and I was asking him, how do you think Ribery will do? And he said, look, he's not the player he was back in 2013. That's obvious, but he's still capable of producing the occasional moment of brilliance. He did it last year with Bayern, so he could be a very good impact sub for Fiorentina this season, or give them, you know, 60 minutes of magic before he runs out of steam. So I hope it goes well for him too down in Florence. But yeah, of the two, I'm hoping, and I'll back Balotelli, even though I've been burned before.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you there for the angle and the romanticism of that. I'm completely with you. Okay, so now I want to ask you about three mid-table teams that are in pretty different situations, and I want to ask you to give me one thing about each of these teams that intrigue you and one thing that concerns you. So let's start with Ribery's team, Fiorentina. Not off to a good start. They lost their first two matches. What intrigues you and what concerns you about them?
That's a good one. What intrigues me about Fiorentina, I suppose, is how long Montella will be given before you know fans start to panic because they're not getting results. As kind of touched on right at the start of the conversation, you know, you don't get an awful lot of time over here. You'd hope for some perspective and some patience, because while they were poor at Genoa, you know, hands down, nobody can argue that. I wouldn't panic. I thought they showed enough against Napoli, you know, a really strong team. And in a game, I didn't think they deserved to lose. As far as I was concerned, I thought they deserved something out of the Napoli match, and we've already seen that Napoli can score goals as well as concede them. But they're still going to be among the title challengers, as we discussed. So there's a few new players there, some interesting players there. Montella is obviously trying something a little bit different. Boateng is an intriguing signing, obviously, given his struggles at Barcelona. But again, we saw that he can do well as a variety of roles, or even as a false nine at Sassuolo. So, and they still have Chiesa, so I mean they should always remain a threat as long as he's happy. I'm intrigued to see how long he gets, and but I'm concerned that he won't be given much time. Yeah, that's probably how I'd put it best.
Okay, so now let's talk about another team that lost their first two matches, and this is Sampdoria. So tell me what intrigues you and what concerns you about them.
I'm intrigued to see how Di Francesco kind of handles this situation at Sampdoria. I thought he was harshly treated at Roma in the end. I thought it was a bit unfair the way he was kind of shown the door after doing great things the previous season, and we talked about the Champions League semi-final run and stuff like that. And Samp is obviously a good chance for him to restore his reputation, but as you say, they've lost the first two games as well. I think they've only scored one goal, seven conceded. What concerns me there is the mental side of the things, how their heads have been dropping. To me, they look fragile, mentally weak, and that's not a good sign at the start of the season, so that'll be a major concern for me.
Okay, so now let's talk about a team that I think is pretty underrated, because they really didn't do much this summer, but they were very solid going into the season, and this is Torino. So tell me what intrigues you and what concerns you about them.
What intrigues me is whether they can keep this going. Obviously, you could argue that they've had a bit of an advantage over a lot of teams in Serie A, because they started the competitive campaign a little bit earlier due to their involvement in the Europa League. So, you know, it gives you a little bit of an edge at the start of the season. You're a little bit fitter, this and that. And obviously, they'll lose that edge over time. But they look a good side to me. I agree with you. I think they're a little bit underrated. They've kind of slipped under the radar. Nobody was really talking about them, but they look extremely well motivated. They're creating a lot of chances. Obviously, they're giving up some of the back. So that would be my concern to lead into that. My concern would be that they concede a lot of goals. That fragility from a defensive perspective was certainly in evidence against Wolves. But what I loved was the way they responded to losing at Molineux during they went and beat Atalanta away. I mean, coming from a goal down to do it, that's a hell of an achievement, you know. That's seriously impressive. So I can totally understand why Mazzarri came out afterwards and said it was one of his best wins of his time at Torino. So, while there are concerns from a defensive perspective, I think there's enough grounds for optimism going forward to see if they can actually sustain, you know, another push for Europe.
Yeah, I'm all in on Torino. I actually think they're going to be considerably better than Fiorentina this season. So now let's talk about the team in your neck of the woods. For those of you not familiar, Mark is based in Bologna. He recently, he was at the game on Friday night, wrote about Mihailovic's first home game of the season. So let's talk about your team. So give me big picture. What's your view of this new version of Bologna?
Yeah, as you say, this is kind of a somewhat exciting kind of new era, and they haven't exactly kind of overhauled the squad during the summer. Somewhat slightly biased, but they look like a team that are growing, developing, becoming more confident. I think they'll be awkward to play against, certainly at home at the Dallara. Going forward, I genuinely think there's quality there. I'm a great admirer of Orsolini in particular. I think he's an absolute handful. I think Sansone is a great threat going forward. Soriano is always capable of popping up with a goal, as he did on Friday against Spal. Obviously, Destro and Santander are maybe somewhat limited centre-forwards, but they're both capable of leading the line well. They offer a focal point in attack. They bring others into the game. They give you something to aim at. But yeah, I suppose the one flip side is that Bologna lack a prolific centre-forward, and if they had one, I think they'd be capable of, you know, pushing towards the top eight or something like that. As it is, they're somewhat limited in that regard, and also maybe they don't have the depth of other teams. But overall, I do like the look of the team. I do like the look of the squad, and I think they'll provide some value for money this season, and at least at home anyway.
Okay, so I want to ask you, I feel in a lot of ways this has been Sabatini's summer of getting his mojo back. We saw Bologna target a lot of prospects abroad that he got for good deals. It feels like back to his Palermo and Roma days, discovering these talents, making a big plusvalenza down the road. So tell me a little bit of the new additions to Bologna. Which ones intrigue you the most and why?
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously the big name one is Medel, is obviously a fascinating boy, and we're all familiar with him anyway. We know what he does. He's relentless, he's tenacious, he's good to watch. He had a good game on Friday night, actually. He got a great reception when he came up. But of the new guys that he's brought in, and as you say, quite rightly said, they've made some really interesting kind of young purchases, and guys maybe that aren't that well known, is the Korean guy, Tomiyasu, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Hopefully I am. But it was the first game, the Spal game was the first time I got to watch him live, and I was really impressed. I think he's a centre-back by trade, but he had a good game at right-back. He was dogged at the back, strong in the tackle, committed, fearless on the ball, always willing to get forward. And he looked a threat at set pieces too. Actually, he went close with a couple of corners. So it was telling that the crowd already seemed to have taken to him, and they like his energy, they like his drive. And I could see why. So of the new guys, he's the one that kind of stood out to me, and he's the one. He'd be the one I'd say, keep an eye over him, actually. He could develop into a very good defender at Bologna. And Bologna have a decent reputation of producing these players every few years that the big boys come and snap away from them.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Mihailovic. Obviously, a story that completely transcends football. I really enjoyed your article on the game on Friday, and at the start you wrote, in the grand scheme of things, that Bologna won a football match against Spal on Friday night means nothing, that Sinisa Mihailovic was there to witness it, though, means everything. So I want to ask you, as someone who is based in Bologna, tell me a little bit, what's the coverage been like of his situation? You know, obviously Mihailovic receiving treatment for leukemia. He has been with the team the first two matches. So tell me a little bit, what's it been like to reading the coverage and doing in you yourself covering this story?
Yeah, I to be honest, I found it from a general perspective, like the media in general and the people and the atmosphere in Bologna, and very respectful, like in no way intrusive, which is how it should be, obviously. I mean, the guy's gone through an obviously a very difficult experience, and it hasn't been over the top. There's obviously been a great demand and interest in the story and how he's doing and his welfare and stuff like that. But it's not like the staff and the players are being inundated with questions on it. I mean, there were only a couple, literally two, on Mihailovic after the press conference or in the post-match press conference on Friday. So it wasn't like everyone is tired of, you know, asking questions or they're pushing it or they're really sensationalizing the story or exploiting it in any way, God forbid. You know, that's the last thing we would want. So I found it that everybody's been very respectful and handled it in a really nice way. After the game, everyone just wanted to talk about football. And at one point, even the Bologna standing coach, the assistant coach, said, you know, we just want to talk about the game. And Mihailovic is so proud of the players, and he credited them. And what I found interesting, I think I said it in the piece, was that after they got the last minute or the injury time winner, he kind of, you know, sneaked away and went down the tunnel before the end. It wasn't like he didn't want to be at the center of the celebrations or anything like that, you know, for a variety of reasons, but he didn't want the spotlight to be on him. And I don't think it has been so far. I think people have handled it in a very nice, respectful, no way intrusive kind of way. And people, it's not about pity. As he said, he didn't want tears, he didn't want pity. It's actually been about unity. And I felt that at the stadium, and I think there was like a great collective sense of joy that their coach, the mister, was back at the stadium. And so, in that sense, it was just a lovely experience. It was a privilege to be there. And to see that kind of outpouring of appreciation from Mihailovic and what he's going through and the battle he faces, and which he'll hopefully overcome, I think was a really nice thing. And I think just being handled well overall.
Great to really get that firsthand perspective on that. So thank you so much. So Mark, this year, what we're doing with our guests, we're going to do some over-unders, and I picked three over-unders on strikers to kind of gauge how you think they are going to do. So let's start with Lukaku. So unfortunately, this is really the exact opposite of what you described in Bologna, the unity with Mihailovic, like what Lukaku has been subjected to in Cagliari. Anyone who follows Serie A knows that this, is not surprising in that city, in that stadium, what's been happening. But, you know, I've been in Italy enough to know that it's a much bigger problem than that. So before I ask you the over-under on Lukaku, I think it would be ignoring the elephant in the room not to ask. Yeah. Your perspective on this situation. What's your takeaway? Do you think there's a solution to this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we could talk for hours about this and the various factors behind it and so on and so forth. But it's bewildering and it's enraging. And as you kind of alluded to there, what the outrageous thing is that what we saw at Cagliari was shocking, not in the least bit surprising. And that's just a staggering state of affairs, because it was almost to be expected, David, as you know, as you said, we're worn out explaining this or apologizing for it. It's just an unacceptable situation. We've seen these racial insults before, Cagliari, with Montari, Matuidi, Kane last year. And it just keeps happening because nothing gets done about it. We could get into all what you want about why, you know, Italy has a problem with racists, you know. Some of them are even in Parliament, you might say. But, Italy is not alone in that regard. There are ignorant fools in office all across the globe right now. So football can't solve racism, but it can get its house in order. And that means adequately punishing those responsible. You know, if someone racially abuses someone at the ground, you do it. And I remember even last year, after the abuse that Moise Kane suffered, Allegri said, don't we have the technology? Don't we have the cameras? Can't we identify these guys and pick them out? David, about 2 hours ago, I sat and watched Sky Sport Italia, and they ran through a demonstration at the Juventus Stadium of how they can identify fans and hooligans and people who are racial abuse. So the technology is there. And why isn't it being used? You know, and why aren't we banning these things? Why aren't we stopping matches? Nobody wants games to be stopped, or abandoned, but nothing is working. Nothing, and everything is being said, but nothing's being done. So at this stage, you just have to say, no, if the players walk off, they walk off, and you award them the victory, you know, if they're being subjected to this crap, for want of a better word. But it's ridiculous. And the Federation has been so weak, and there's no deterrent at the moment to this, and nobody's doing anything. And I feel like if you can't stop these guys doing it, then you stop football, which is a terrible sad state of affairs, but you have to stop the matches, because this just can't go on anymore. And it is. I'm waiting with serious skepticism to see what the reaction will be to this. But I'm just worn out, as I imagine everybody else is at this stage.
I'm with you there. I wonder, there's always this outrage culture in 2019. Maybe this is one time that the outrage culture can help, because to me, it's such a black eye on the league. I mean, once again, we had a great weekend of Serie A action. Like, you and I cover the league. We know that this weekend was a typical Serie A weekend. Great games. But unfortunately and rightfully, this stuff takes precedence on the coverage, and it's a real shame. But back to football. So let's just do an over-under on Lukaku. He has 2 goals already. If I said the over-under at 18.5 for the season, so he has to score 17 more to go over, would you take the over or the under?
I'm going to take the over because I didn't even know before the game that he was going to be taking penalties as well. So
yeah,
that's a nice bonus. And as I've said before with Lukaku, if a team is playing to his strengths, Lukaku will score goals. And I expect him. The way I look at this team, this Inter team at the moment, the way they're set up, I think it's going to suit him. It's almost like very, very similar to the way he plays with Belgium. Obviously, I'm not saying they have the exact same players around them, or the exact same format, or the exact same quality of, you know, Kevin De Bruyne and stuff like that. But I think it's a team in which Lukaku will score goals. I think he's playing alongside a guy that he will enjoy playing alongside in Lautaro. So I didn't expect. Yeah, I think he'll do it. I think he'll get more than. I think he'll get his more than 18 goals or 19 goals.
So. Okay, awesome. Yeah, most people have picked that. So the next two are a little bit harder. Let's go with Piontek, who was benched yesterday, but on a Saturday, but actually looked pretty good when he came on. If I set the over-under at 15.5 for Piontek, what are you taking?
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. I was thinking the same thing. When he came on, he looked lively. They created a lot of chances in that last few minutes. And obviously, Silva is going to leave now. So, I mean, to me, he's the obvious number 9. He should start every game. I think Milan will hopefully improve as the season goes on. So, yeah, he looks, when he's in form, we know he's a guy who goes on streaks, and when he's on a hot streak, he scores a lot of goals. So I'm gonna back him. Yeah, I'm gonna say he'll score more than 15.
Okay, last one, Zeko, and this one to me is interesting because a lot of people think I said the over under way too low at 12.5, but he only had 9 last season. Now, granted, he's looked good in Fonseca's system. Do you believe he's gonna score more than 12.5 goals?
I'll be honest with you. Actually, I didn't know you were going. You had people saying that to you about the over under thing. I thought it was low initially when I looked at it, and then the more I started to think about it, I was like, okay, actually, this one is tricky because he should score loads, but I'm not entirely sure if he's still, happy to be at Roma. I think, as I mentioned earlier, Roma should be a good side, attack-oriented, attack-minded side, very offensive, should score, create plenty of chances. But, I'm going to be controversial, but maybe controversial, and say under. And, knowing my luck and my skills as a gambler, I'll be proven wrong inside 2 months.
Awesome. Well, Mark, one thing, you definitely have great ability, is breaking down the game. I can't thank you enough for joining us. Definitely all you aspiring writers, up-and-coming writers, check out Mark's articles. Really tremendous. He has one pinned on his page right now on Bologna. So, Mark, always a pleasure chatting with you. I look forward to bringing you back on during the season and talking more culture with you.
Absolutely. I look forward to it, too. It's always a pleasure and always good crack, as we say back home. Thanks very much.